A whole world of trouble.
Marketplace Morning Report is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
From American Public Media in Los Angeles, I'm Scott Jagow. The struggles of the auto industry aren't limited to American companies. Today, Toyota said it's shutting down all of its North American plants for 2 days next month. It can't move enough cars. In fact, they're backed up at the port of Long Beach. Looks like a huge car dealership out there with unwanted Toyotas, Nissans, Mercedes. A port spokesman says this is one way to look at the economy, and it scares him to death. Meantime, the big three are back on Capitol Hill today to plead their case one more time. But even if there's a bailout, if no one's buying cars, what good will it do? Marketplace's Janet Babin reports from North Carolina Public Radio.
A $25 billion bailout would help the big three fund their operations, but customers might still stay away. Who wants a car from a company that might not be around next year? What about your warranty or your service center? Susan Helper at Case Western Reserve University says that could be addressed in the bailout legislation. She says money could be put in escrow for warranty repairs.
When the dealer fixes your car under warranty, the dealer could just apply to this fund for repayment rather than to the automaker. So that should relieve some of the concern that warranties wouldn't be honored.
Helper says after the first Chrysler bailout in 1979, the government netted a profit of more than $300 million. Even with the bailout, few consumers will have the cash or be able to get the loans needed to buy new cars. Helper says that's why the government has to pass a wider stimulus package. While the House considers a bailout for the big three, the Senate could vote on its plan as early as today. I'm Janet Babin for Marketplace.
Wall Street is very keen to see what Congress will do, but this morning stocks are hanging in there, even though we have two more recessionary numbers. New home construction hit an all-time low last month, and consumer prices had their biggest drop on record. So far, just small losses for Wall Street. The Dow is down 15 points, the NASDAQ down a couple, the S&P 500 down 3. European shares, bigger losses, about 3%. And there were some minor losses in Asia by the close. Today, the Food and Drug Administration opened its first overseas office in China. It's an obvious choice considering the recent list of food scares coming out of China. I'm joined now by our correspondent in Shanghai, Scott Tong. Scott, what's the FDA hope to accomplish here?
The point is for U.S. checkers of food to move past the borders, where traditionally United States officials check food coming in from China and other places. It's to go closer to where the point of origin is.
And is the FDA thinking this is the solution to the problem of tainted food and other products getting into this country?
Well, surprise, surprise, it's not going to be the silver bullet. China has something like 400,000 small food processors. I mean, they're little tiny plants and farms, and it's so fragmented. And so it's impossible for anyone to check every single one. So the risks will always be there. The hope is that these risks get minimized when the right people are involved.
And is this just a one-off with China, or is the FDA planning to expand this in other countries?
Oh, it's in a lot of places in the world. There will be three offices in China and India, in Europe, and Latin America. The point, as the FDA official said today, is to globalize the agency's mission, because more and more of what Americans eat comes from overseas. It's something like 15% of food that Americans eat is imported now. And as far as China's concerned, there is a China footprint, whether you know it or not, in a lot of aisles in the supermarket. It's vitamins, dietary supplements, processed foods, on and on. It's more globalized than most of us know, and the FDA is trying to keep up with that.
Scott Tong, our correspondent in Shanghai. Thank you.
Okay, Scott.
This is the Morning Report for Wednesday, November 19th on Marketplace.org. The election's over, and it's time to start thinking about the swearing-in. But before the officiating starts, incoming Democrats are at this very moment learning the value of money in politics. Congressman John Dingell is co-hosting a fundraiser for the freshmen today. Here's Marketplace's Nancy Marshall Genzer.
Today's lesson for incoming Democrats: you scratch my back, I'll give you money. Michigan Democrat John Dingell is fighting to keep his chairmanship of the House Energy and Commerce Committee. California Democrat Henry Waxman wants the job. The freshman Democrats get to vote on the chair. Dingell's fundraiser will help pay off their campaign debts with lobbyist donations. Joan Claybrook is president of Public Citizen. She says lawmakers are being corrupted before they even take office.
The new members are the most vulnerable. They are the most in need of money, and they often have a debt when they come to Congress.
Sunlight Foundation senior fellow Bill Allison says some members host their own fundraisers this time of year, many with a holiday message.
Season's greetings, and maybe it's a good time for a lobbyist to donate to a member of Congress.
Congressman Dingell's office issued a statement. It says, in part, that Dingell understands the importance of helping members retire their debt quickly. In Washington, I'm Nancy Marshall Genzer for Marketplace.
While some CEOs of big companies were on Capitol Hill pushing another economic stimulus package, other big company CEOs are banding together on global warming. Starbucks, Nike, Levi's. Here's Sarah Gardner at the Marketplace Sustainability Desk.
These corporations call themselves Business for Innovative Climate and Energy Policy, or BICEP, and they're flexing a little muscle in the debate over energy and climate change. Here's what they want. No new coal plants unless they capture CO2, a national mandate for renewable energy, and a carbon cap and trade system that auctions off pollution permits instead of giving them away for free. Starbucks executive Ben Packard.
The critical issue for us is that the places where we depend on for our core product, coffee, could be significantly impacted by a change in our climate.
BICEP is calling for more aggressive and specific steps than the U.S. Climate Action Partnership, another business coalition. This new group also aims to offset the message of another big business player, the U.S. Chamber of Commerce. The chamber has been warning lately that greenhouse gas regulation will just make the weak economy worse. I'm Sarah Gardner for Marketplace.
A new report ranks states by the climate for new economic growth. What's the best place to launch a business? From the entrepreneurship desk at Oregon Public Broadcasting, Mitchell Hartman reports.
And the winner is Massachusetts, followed by Washington, Maryland, Delaware, and New Jersey. The list isn't all that surprising. These states have lots of knowledge workers and world-class R&D in fields like biotech and clean technology. Bob Lighton of the Kauffman Foundation says a hyperactive environment for startups is also a good sign.
You'll see a lot of firm births and firm deaths because a dynamic economy is one in which there's a lot of churn.
Lighton says regions with old economy farming and manufacturing are now coming up in the world.
Take, for example, the Great Plains states. There's a lot of bio this and bio that can be converted into energy.
Lighton says the combination of natural resources and well-funded university research could make the Midwest the hub of an entrepreneurial revolution in renewable energy. I'm Mitchell Hartman for Marketplace.
The financial crisis fallout is affecting countries all over the world. This morning, we're off to Saltillo, Mexico, known as Little Detroit for its many car-related manufacturing companies. From our America's desk at WLRN in Miami, Dan Gretsch reports.
Ecolimpio is an eerie place at dusk. An earth mover transfers huge mounds of toxic dirt. Noxious fluids chug through a pipe. Every week, auto part makers in Saltillo send their hazardous waste here to be processed. But recently, deliveries started falling off. Ecolimpio's owner, Daniel Calvert, says he knew then that the local auto industry had begun to run cold.
Oh, yes, we're a thermometer. Industries put aside their legal obligations on hazardous waste until things get better.
Calvert stands in a warehouse with stacks of metal drums. The stacks used to be higher.
We're losing money. We diminished 8%.
What was that sound?
Just a bird. They fly and they crash in the drum.
Mexico's auto industry is like that bird. It was soaring as automakers from around the world set up shop in towns like Saltillo. They came for the country's cheaper labor and its proximity to the U.S. In one generation, Saltillo took in billions in investment. Its population doubled. Then auto sales in the U.S. took a nosedive. Mexican auto exports fell more than 15% in August compared to 1 year ago. Chrysler laid off a third of its workers at its Saltillo truck plant. Oscar Peart heads the local chamber of commerce. He also manufactures custom-built door holders used when painting pickup trucks. He says Mexico's other motor cities are suffering too.
There have been big drops in orders at some plants, such as in Silao, Mexico City, Chihuahua, and Sonora. Here, we are actually a little bit better off. We have very versatile assembly plants that allow us to change what we manufacture quickly.
Peart says his family, his business, his entire city depends on Detroit.
To survive, we will have to do what we call in Mexico to tie up our guts. We have to learn to save things like paper, pencil, electricity, and water.
Chrysler is building a massive Freightliner truck plant in the town. It's scheduled to open in February. But with American automakers in deep financial trouble, the future of Saltillo's plants could be up in the air. This town they call Little Detroit could soon get even smaller. In Saltillo, Mexico, I'm Dan Gretsch for Marketplace.
There's lots of speculation about who will land positions in Barack Obama's cabinet. But Obama might also add some other positions into the mix, like czars. Commentator Will Wilkinson doesn't like that idea.
Remember America's can-do point man in the war on drugs, the so-called drug czar? Well, if you like czars, you'll love President-elect Barack Obama. He's proposing a new technology czar, he's considering a climate czar, and he's even floated the idea of a car czar. In tough times like these, America does not need a dose of tragic Russian authoritarianism. America does not need more czars. Did you know that the Constitution does not mention czars even once? I know, weird. The president's cabinet is composed of heads of various executive offices. These offices, like the Department of Education, are generally proposed by the president and approved by Congress. But the president can create new sub-cabinet-level offices more or less at will, which is where most so-called czars dwell. Since Nixon created the first energy czar in 1973, our government has become czar-crazy. But why? Has a czar ever delivered anything more than the illusion that somebody's got things under control? Jimmy Carter bestowed upon America two inflation czars who then czared inflation to all-time highs. Reagan gave us the drug czar, and now that problem's licked. Czars and special new offices are mainly political theater, the equivalent of looking busy. But they can do harm. Czarmania is a symptom of the dangerous ongoing expansion of executive power. The idea that we need an executive branch czar implies that our democratic lawmaking bodies don't have sufficiently singular will to just get it done. Czars are too often a cosmetic reaction to problems government itself created. Politicians promise much, but government too rarely delivers. In the end, it's the innovation and enterprise of private citizens, not a swarm of pint-sized Caesars, that really delivers the goods.
Will Wilkinson is a research fellow at the Cato Institute. You can find a link to his blog on our website, marketplace.org, and you can also share your thoughts with us as well. In Los Angeles, I'm Scott Jagow. Thanks for listening, and have a great day.
American Public Media.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.